It was 9 a.m. when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, King of the Jews. They crucified 2 rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross so that we may see and believe. Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And at 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near heard this, they said, Listen, he's calling Elijah. Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion, who stood there in front of Jesus, saw how he died, he said, Surely this man was the Son of God.
As we saw from the kids' slot, I think you've got to say that the cross is the main symbol of Christianity, the main logo, if you like, for Christianity. I guess there'd be other contenders. You might want to make the case for a fish or perhaps a dove. But really, I think the cross is the symbol. But it does raise a question, doesn't it? Why would you have the cross as the symbol of Christianity? Why would you put the cross right at the center of what Christians believe? What's so important about Jesus' death on the cross that it's right at the middle, right in the middle, central to everything that Christians believe? Perhaps if you're here this morning and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, you're looking in on Christian things. Maybe that's a question that you've asked yourself. If you're a Christian here this morning, maybe it's the sort of thing that someone else might have asked you. Why the cross? What's so important about the cross? I mean, when you think about it, the symbol of a cross, well, it is a slightly odd symbol, isn't it? To have a method of execution as the symbol of a world religion, the acceptable symbol of a world religion. Well, it is slightly weird when you think about it. At the end of this month, it's Ellie's birthday, Ellie, my wife's birthday, and it may be that I would want to get her some jewellery for her birthday. Here's some examples of jewellery that you can find. All of these are available on the internet, and maybe I could get Ellie one of these delightful necklaces. If you can't see at the back or online, there are 4 necklaces here, all of them with different methods of execution. So there's a necklace with a mini electric chair, a necklace that says, I love firing squads, a little lethal injection necklace, and there's a cross. They're all methods of execution. And I guess, for the most part, they'd be slightly odd presents to get for someone you love. Except for the cross, which I guess might be fairly normal, fairly acceptable. The cross is the symbol of Christianity, right at the very heart of what Christians believe. Last week, if you were here or listened online, you'll remember that Pete was encouraging us to be Jesus-centered this year, Jesus-centered in 2022. And right at the heart of Jesus' life and ministry is his death on the cross. So if we're going to be Jesus-centered, well, then we need to be cross-centered. If you're not convinced of that, then when you get a moment, have a read through Mark's Gospel, chapters 8, 9, and 10, where Jesus himself repeatedly makes it clear that dying on the cross is right at the center of his life and ministry. Three times in those chapters, Jesus says that explicitly. Let me read to you a few verses from Mark chapter 10. If you're taking notes, it's Mark chapter 10, 32 to 34. It says this: they were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed him were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen. "We're going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Couldn't be much clearer, could it? The cross is right at the center of Jesus' life and ministry. But why? What's so important about Jesus' death on the cross? After all, for most people, Jesus' death on the cross doesn't make a great deal of sense. I think for many people, if they give it any thought at all, it's a sort of tragedy, isn't it? Jesus, the great teacher and leader, tragically killed in his prime. For some, Jesus' death makes so little sense that they deny that he died at all. That's certainly what your Muslim friends believe. Others, I think, would see Jesus' death as perhaps an example of self-sacrifice. But if you push them on what that self-sacrifice achieves, they'd struggle to give you an answer. And even, I think, amongst Christians, there's a fair amount of confusion about what is exactly going on as Jesus dies on the cross. Why is it so important? Why is it central to Jesus' life and ministry? So at the start of a new year, a year where we want to be Christ-focused, it's great that we're thinking about these sorts of questions and so getting ourselves cross-focused. This week we're going to be thinking a bit about what happens at the cross, if you like, the God business, the theology of the cross. And then next week we're going to spend a bit of time looking at the implications of the cross, what it means for us in our everyday lives to have a right understanding of the cross and for the cross to be central to the way that we live. So if it's helpful, perhaps I could put it this way. This week we're going to get our thinking straight about the cross, so that next week we can get our living straight in line with the cross. So what is going on as Jesus dies on the cross, and why is it so important? Well, I think as we zoom in on these events on the cross in Mark chapter 15, we're reminded of three really clear lessons. Here's the first. God was angry. God was angry. Have a look down at Mark chapter 15 and verse 33. "At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. So it's midday, and we're in a country with plenty of sunshine. It's quite nice today, isn't it? But in the last week or so, we've had some pretty gloomy days, weather-wise, that is, haven't we? A couple of times, I reckon at about 2:30 in the afternoon, I've looked out of the window and thought, it's getting dark already. But this takes place, Mark chapter 15 takes place in a land of sunshine in the Middle East. And it goes properly dark, not just cloudy, not a bit gloomy because of the weather, but proper nighttime darkness in the middle of the day. I think for any of us, that would be a bit ominous. It'd be a bit unnerving. But even more so if we were in that crowd of mainly Jewish onlookers. They would have remembered that often in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, in the first half of the Bible, darkness was a sign that God was judging. God was punishing sin. So, for example, with Moses, when God sends the 10 plagues on Egypt to rescue the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, one of the plagues, you'll remember, is the plague of darkness. So in Exodus chapter 10, verse 21, it says this, "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sky so that darkness spreads over Egypt, darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days." The plagues, I'm sure you know, were all about God judging Egypt. So darkness tells us that God is judging, God is punishing sin. The Bible tells us that sin is rejecting God and rejecting God's right rule over our lives. When we're teaching this to kids at camp, we often use the illustration of taking the crown off God's head and putting it on ours. Sin says, "No, God, I don't want you to be king. I want to be king." It's treason. And the Bible teaches us that it's punishable by death. In this country, it is against the law to commit treason or high treason. The Treason Act of 1397 still stands today. It's had one or two additions and changes over the years, but essentially it's the same law that was passed in the reign of Richard II. Although one big change these days is that if you're found guilty of treason in this country, you won't be executed. But when the law was first introduced, and for hundreds of years afterwards, treason against the rightful ruler was punishable by death. Well, treason against God the King is equally punishable by death. And the complete darkness tells us that God is angry at sin. God is acting in judgment, punishing sin, and that means death. So just like in Egypt, it's a giant visual aid telling people that God is angry once again. Of course, when you think about it, it's no surprise that God should be angry. Human sin demands God's anger. When we look at the world and even our lives, we shouldn't be surprised that he's angry. Some people, I think, dismiss the idea of God being angry as if it would somehow compromise his goodness, as if God should just forgive everyone and turn a blind eye to evil. I think that's often to confuse a righteous anger or God's anger with our sort of irrational or unrighteous or flying off the handle anger. God's anger's not like that. And it wouldn't be goodness to just ignore sin, would it? What sort of a God wouldn't be angry at a world full of war and wickedness, selfishness and sin, corruption and crime? A world where we overthrow his rightful rule, even though he gives us so much. God's anger shouldn't surprise us. But the surprise in these verses comes when we work out where God's anger is directed, where God's punishment is directed. In other words, who's taking the punishment? And this is the second truth, the second point. Jesus is abandoned. Jesus is abandoned. And the clue's there in verse 34. 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The cry tells us that Jesus is the one taking the punishment. God is judging sin, but Jesus is the one being punished. And that is a surprise, or at least it should be. Jesus is the perfect Son of God who's always lived in perfect relationship to God. And yet here he is crying out because he's been abandoned. So what's going on? Well, interestingly, there's another similarity here with the plagues in Egypt. The plague of darkness was the ninth plague, the penultimate plague in Egypt. And the plague that followed immediately afterwards, the tenth plague, was the death of the firstborn Egyptian sons. They died so that Israel could go free. Well, fast forward a couple of thousand years, and again, here's darkness over the whole land, this time for 3 hours, not 3 days. And the darkness this time is followed by a death, the death of the firstborn son of God, who dies so we can go free. You see, Jesus is willingly dying in the place of mankind, in the place of sinful mankind. The cry tells us that Jesus is lovingly taking the punishment for the sins of the world so that he is abandoned. He dies cut off from God the Father. Jesus is abandoned. It's right at the heart of what's going on at the cross. A few summers ago, Rhys, my son, and I visited Auschwitz, a concentration camp in Poland, which, as you know, was one of the notorious Nazi death camps in World War II. We were shown around on a tour, and as part of a tour, they showed us the cell of a man called Maximilian Kolbe. Many of you, I suspect, will have heard his story. The cell is where he died. Kolbe was sent to Auschwitz for hiding Jewish people from the Nazis. In July 1941, three prisoners appeared to have escaped from the camp. And as a result, the deputy commander of the camp ordered that 10 men be chosen to be starved to death in an underground cell. One of those men was a chap called Francis Gazwanacek. And when Gazwanacek was selected, he cried out, "My wife, my children." And at this point, Kolbe, who hadn't been chosen, stepped forward and volunteered to take his place. Rather surprised, the Nazi commander accepted Kolbe in place of Gazwanacek. And those 10 men were led away to the underground cell where they were starved to death. And you can visit the cell today. Miraculously and interestingly, Gazwanacek survived Auschwitz. So he was able to speak about this afterwards and reflect on that moment when Kolbe steps forward to take his place. Here's what he said. "I was stunned and could hardly grasp what was going on, the immensity of it. I, the condemned, am to live, and someone else willingly and voluntarily offers his life for me, a stranger. Is this some dream?" Kolbe dies in Gazwanacek's place. He willingly gives his life for him. Well, on a much, much, much bigger scale, that is what Jesus does when he dies on the cross. He dies taking the punishment for sin that people like you and me deserve, for the way that we've rebelled against God. That's why there's darkness when Jesus dies, because he's suffering God's right anger at human sin in our place. He died that we might live. Now, just in case you think I'm making a bit more of this than just the darkness or the cry allows, then this is a doctrine that's taught throughout the rest of the New Testament. Let me just give you a couple of examples, and you could take a note of these, look them up during the week. So in Romans chapter 3, verses 23 and following, says this, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith." Or 1 John chapter 2, "My dear children, I write this to you so that you will not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. He is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not only for our sins, but also for the sins of the whole world." Of course, it's not just a New Testament idea. It has its roots in the Old Testament sacrificial system, which looked forward to Jesus's perfect sacrifice. So Isaiah 53, familiar verses, I imagine. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Many of you will know that the technical or theological term for this cosmic swap is substitutionary atonement. Substitutionary, taking the place, taking someone else's place. Atonement, paying for wrongdoing or paying for sin. Jesus dies, taking the punishment that's for sin that people like you and me deserve for the way that we've rebelled against God the King. Now, at this point, some people object to the cross. They say that isn't it unjust that God the Father punishes the innocent Jesus for someone else's sin? Steve Chalk, who certainly used to be a well-known, high-profile Christian leader, he describes that understanding of what's going on at the cross as cosmic child abuse. But that's really to fail to understand what was going on at the cross, because Jesus isn't an innocent third party. No, Jesus is God himself. Jesus is God the Son. And as God himself, as God the Son, as the one who's been sinned against, he's able to grant us forgiveness while in himself meeting the requirements for justice. Nor is Jesus some innocent bystander who's sort of forced to suffer for someone else's crime. No, he willingly and freely chooses to suffer instead of us out of love for us. It's the most amazing love imaginable when you think about it, isn't it? And it means wonderfully that we can be accepted by God. And this is our third truth, our third heading. We can be accepted. We can be accepted by God. And the great news is that even in this passage, as we see Jesus' death to pay the punishment that we deserve, we see that it really works. The clue this time is in the curtain at verse 37. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain in the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This curtain hung in the temple, separating the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple. The Holy of Holies was the place where God dwelt, at least symbolically. And he dwelt there away from sinful human beings. Only the high priest, once a year, after a whole load of ritual washing and sacrificing, can go into the Holy of Holies. As you head south on the A3, south of Godalming, you'll know that there are masses of areas of sort of MOD land down that way, like the Longmoor Ranges. And there's land that's still used for live firing exercises. So although you can walk on the land and there's footpaths on the land and so on, they have a sort of flag system to warn you if there's going to be live firing going on. And all around the place, there are big signs up, big sort of skull and crossbone type signs, which say, MOD land, keep out of this part, or don't pick up any bombs that you discover, and things like that. Danger of death, keep out, danger of death. And the curtain in the temple hanging over the entrance to the Holy of Holies acts like a massive keep out sign, danger of death. God is the awesome, holy God who cannot tolerate sin. So normal human beings, sinful human beings, couldn't possibly go into his presence. It's just too dangerous. Danger of death. And it's this massive curtain, which as Jesus dies on the cross, is torn in two from top to bottom. Because now it's possible to get to God. I mean, that message is really clear, isn't it? Jesus' death on the cross works. Jesus' death to take the punishment that we deserve really works. Now it's possible to get to God. Possible for ordinary, imperfect, sinful people like you and me to get to God. And that is great news. That is the best news in the world. Jesus' death means that we can be forgiven, clean on the inside, and have access to God, have a relationship with the God who made us and welcomed into God's family. Whoever we are, whatever we've done, we can be accepted. That's the result of the cross. And if that sounds too good to be true, have a look at the centurion. He's there in verse 39. When the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." As Jesus dies, the Roman centurion, who's presumably there overseeing his execution, recognizes that Jesus is the Son of God. Remember, Romans don't believe in God. They believed in the gods. And yet here is the centurion overseeing Jesus' death, and he recognizes that Jesus is the Son of God. Perhaps he's on his way to being forgiven and becoming a follower of Jesus. Jesus' death means that anyone can be accepted by God. Anyone can be forgiven. Anyone can get to God. Even a Roman centurion, even people like you and me. So why is the cross an appropriate symbol for Christianity? Why is it that the cross is right at the heart of what Christians believe? Well, the cross tells us that God is angry, or God was angry. Jesus is abandoned, and that we can be accepted. As we close, I want to draw two quick implications of all this. We'll do a bit more on the implications and practical outworkings next week. But here are a couple of thoughts to chew on until then. First of all, the cross is central. The cross is central. I guess that's the point of it being the symbol. The cross is central to what Christians believe. So central to our understanding and our explaining of the Christian faith. I think lots of people think that the Christianity is a moral code or a set of ideas about God and the world. And sadly, many churches, I think, occasionally reduce Christianity to just being about nice people in this world or attempting to make society a slightly better place. But you see, if that's all it is, then there would be no need for Jesus to die. But because the world's biggest problem is actually God's anger at mankind's sin, the cross is absolutely central to the Christian message, because that's where forgiveness can be found. It's why Jesus came into the world. So no matter how foolish that may sound in a very intellectual world, no matter how weak that may sound in a world that values strength and power, no matter how offensive that may sound in a world that doesn't like to be told that it's sinful or needs saving, the cross is central to what Christians believe. And notice second, the cross is sufficient. In other words, the cross is enough. We don't need anything more than the cross to be rescued by God and brought into relationship with him. It's sufficient. So the question we need to ask as we close this morning is whether we're trusting in the cross for ourselves. Is that what we're relying on to be forgiven? Is that what we're still relying on to be forgiven? Do we recognize that God was angry, and rightfully so, because of our sin, but that we can be accepted because Jesus was abandoned? Have we personally, and are we still personally, putting our trust in Jesus' death in our place so that we can receive his forgiveness? Can I say, if you haven't done that ever, or you've stopped doing that, well, do make sure you do something about it. Perhaps speak to someone even before you leave today. After all, wouldn't the start of a new year be a great time to be doing that?